This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Only 4% of the violence, and that's not just gun violence, but any kind in the United States, is attributable to schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or depression, which are the three most cited mental illnesses in conjunction with violence. But according to UK statistics, more than one-third of the public believe that people with mental health problems are more likely to be violent. Here to separate the myths from the facts of the relationship between mental illness and violence is consultant psychiatrist Dr. Philip George. Dr. Philip, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Trilin. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good in the sense that we are good, but the world doesn't seem to be so good these days, does it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were just discussing a little bit earlier. It's almost every two or three days that you see some incidences that really shock you and scare you. Yeah, it's sad.
This latest one, though, that happened in London, or at least one of the latest ones, has been kind of attributed to mental health as opposed to, any sort of radicalization or terrorism. Mm. Mental health, I don't know, is it synonymous with being dangerous? Could you elaborate on that? Is that just a myth?
Yeah. No, I think it is really a myth. And I think that's my take-home message from this show. A lot of studies have been done. And overall, it shows that the mentally ill are no more violent than people, the normal people. I mean, again, who's normal to start with? But so they're no more violent. And sometimes, in some conditions, they may be perhaps just as violent. But there is no difference between those with mental illness and the normal general population.
And what about to oneself if you are living with mental illness? I mean, we're talking about the general population or people around them, but what about violence towards yourself?
Yeah, in fact, that's the thing that is actually more worrying. Self-harm is actually more common than violence towards others in people with mental illness. In fact, 90% of suicides around the world are reported related to mental health issues, and the most common cause is major depression.
How would you define violence and aggression? I mean, what are we talking about here? Is it just outbursts or is it physical? I mean, what falls into that category?
Well, broadly, aggression is both in the mind as well as in the behavior, but violence is usually the outward expression of that negative behavior. And so it has to link in with other people, interactions with others. So aggression can actually be completely within the mind itself.
So you could have a very aggressive mindset without ever acting violently.
Yes.
Okay. And earlier I mentioned these three conditions, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and depression. Yeah. Why are these three more likely to be linked with aggression?
Okay, so we actually divide mental disorders into the most severe major mental disorders and the minor mental disorders. But saying that, it's still a misnomer because, you know, the minor mental disorders still do cause quite a bit of disability. But among the major mental disorders include people who lose touch with reality. They don't know what's right or wrong, and that's because the connections in their mind are not seeming to work as appropriately as they should. And so these would include people with schizophrenia, and sometimes people with bipolar mood disorders, depending on what type of bipolar mood disorder. The type 1 is more serious than the type 2. And then major depression when it's severe, because they lose touch with reality in some instances as well.
We're talking about violence and mental health today. If you'd like to give us a call, that number is 03-771-09000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. I've read about this this condition or this situation, intermittent explosive behavior. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, it's actually classified in our classification of mental disorders as under habit impulse control disorder. So that's something similar to kleptomania. People have a habit or impulse that they can't stop, although they know it brings them trouble and, puts them into jeopardy. But they can't stop it. And so sometimes it's related to behavior that's in terms of aggression and violence. One of the typical things that we often see is people who can't control themselves with road rage. And, you know, simple little things would spark off huge anger and frustration and acting out. which doesn't last very long, and in the end ends up with regret. And so this is typically what is identified as intermittent explosive disorder. But it's not a common disorder. Very often people who do lack control in aggression and violence usually may also have some other condition underlying that as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask whether it was linked, because it sounds more like, I mean, just listening to it, it sounds more like a child having a tantrum. You know, is it along those lines, except in adults where you lack the same sort of impulse controls?
Yep. I mean, it's people who've maybe had childhood experiences or stressful experiences growing up that they can't cope with, and they're dealing with it in their day-to-day life, and things that may bring semblance of what they experienced in the past. Anxiety, fear brings these behaviors, and that's their way of coping with these experiences as well.
We're talking about this today because in the news in particular, violence, including mass shooting, acts of terrorism, gun violence, they're often linked to mental health. Why does that happen?
Yeah, well, I think media has a big role to play in that. You know, we see movies and you've got that guy with that knife in the corner of the room in the shade, in the dark, and he's got a mental illness and he's hearing voices and he's stabbing out at people. And so we've sort of, fixed in our mind this precept notion of people with a mental illness. And I think the media has a big role to play in how they report things. You know, so when a mentally ill person actually acts out and does some aggression, it gets perhaps bigger news and story than somebody who, did some robbery and hurt somebody else. So I think that's one of the issues. The second is the unknown. And so a lot of people worry about the unknown. They see people who behave and act oddly and bizarre, not similar to what they do. And so they're worried, and then they get anxious about, is this going to bring fear? I mean, is this going to bring violence and, hurt to them? So I think a lot of it is related to what we hear and see. But in actual fact, general public are not as, as in danger as compared to perhaps the immediate family. When there is aggression and violence by people who have mental illness, the most common people who may be the victims of this are the family members.
Is there any truth at all in the notion that the mentally ill are at increased risk of violence? Is there an increased risk at all? I mean, I'm not saying that it's a constant association, but is there that element to it?
The risk is the same as with normal individuals. So putting them through the same stress would also trigger off a violent episode or aggression. And so imagine somebody who has no mental illness at all and is put in a corner and challenged and, criticized or treated with hostility, they might act out. And the same with a person who has mental illness. And that sometimes happens more in people with mental illness because they're often marginalized. They're often discriminated. They're often told or given messages that are, demeaning. And so they have to experience the same thing, which maybe other people who don't have a mental illness don't have to experience.
Okay. I was listening to a podcast recently, and it explored the notion that some people are sometimes overrun by thoughts of violence, to the extent that they are worried about harming their family, they're worried about harming their wives, their dogs, and they sought help for it. And eventually it turned out to be, I think, obsessive harm disorder, which was a separate thing. But I am curious about this, where do we need to worry about people who have aggressive thoughts, even if they are not at this moment in time committing violent acts?
Yeah. So actually the role of the psychiatrist and mental health worker is to assess dangerousness. And so in assessments, we actually assess danger to themselves, danger to people around them, and even danger to their reputation, because these are the three big risk issues in mental health. And so with most mental illnesses, the assessment includes all of this. And each disorder has got a specific sort of area where there can be danger to others as well. And with the proper assessment, we can, you know, maybe then address this and do the appropriate interventions to prevent it from getting escalated. People with obsessive compulsive disorder can have recurring thoughts of hurting someone. They don't act on it because they know it's insensible, but it tortures them to hell because the thought keeps coming back to them. And they're worried if they're actually going to act on it someday or sometime, although they go through it for maybe months on end. And the anxiety that builds when they try and stop the thought is just so disabling. So with treatment, actually, all of that comes down. They get more control, the anxiety is gone, and they challenge these thoughts as well.
So that's where you factor in, right? Basically, yeah. To ensure that these thoughts don't, A, you know, hopefully don't get acted on, and B, that the people who have them are able to keep them under control?
Absolutely, yeah. I think the more people are aware about mental disorders and illnesses, and the more they're willing to look for help and, you know, find interventions that are effective, the less the chance of the people with mental illness actually acting out aggressively or violently, although they don't do it as often or maybe just as often as the general population.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist. We're discussing the links between violence and mental health, or rather we're talking about how those links are really just myths. If you've got any questions for us today on the subject or on any other subject to do with your mental health, give us a call. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin in the studio with me, consultant psychiatrist Dr. Philip George. And we're separating the myths from the facts of the relationship between mental illness and violence. So we alluded to this earlier, but in the last few years, and even in this year itself, in the immediate aftermath of any horrific acts of mass terror that have occurred in the US and Europe, commentators have been quick to label the perpetrators of these incidents as mentally ill. We have Omar Mateen, who committed the deadliest shooting in U.S. history in the Orlando nightclub attack. Yeah. We have Mohamed Lawej Boulel, who plowed into dozens of people during the Bastille Day parade. We have the German Wings flight that crashed into the Alps with the pilot having had a history, apparently, of depression. Why do these links continue to persist? Why is it that this linking of violence and mental illness is so quick to happen?
Yeah. Well, again, I think it's, you know, the unknown and trying to figure out what risk issues there are. But often the risk factors are just the same as the general population. So people with a mental illness or mental health problem may be also using substances. And we know that substances actually increase the risk of aggression and violence. And so in normal individuals who use certain substances, they may be at higher rate of being violent and aggressive. People with mental illness also may be exposed or influenced by different sort of messages. So, you know, terrorism can be a message not just for those without mental illness, but also for those with mental illness. And when you combine the two together, then there's a higher risk of perhaps violence and aggression as well. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be just one. It can be a combination as well.
Is violent behavior gendered?
Yes. Generally, I mean, if you look at...
Because even the headlines that we were talking about, unfortunately, all the perpetrators are men.
Are men, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so even in our own experience in psychiatry, patients who are admitted to a psychiatric ward are usually because of risk of violence to themselves or to others. And we have more male admissions than female admissions. We have more male beds than female beds in all psychiatric hospitals and units throughout the country. So, yes, it is more gendered in terms of males more than females. But again, some of the risk factors, when they occur together, then it may also increase the risk in females as well to be aggressive and violent.
Do we know why that gender line exists? I mean, what is it?
Yeah, well, basically with symptoms in mental illness itself, They vary from male to female. And so in males, it may be more behavioral. And so that's where aggression and violence may occur. In females, it may be more related to thought and processes. And so, you know, there may be less in terms of behavioral symptoms. Very often we see women with mental illnesses being protected by communities for years on end. They may be locked away in a room. They don't come out. They just stay away. And there's, you know, they're easily hidden because they don't act out on it. But men would act out, and so they sometimes actually come in for treatment at an earlier stage than women do. And that's a little sad because, you know, the earlier they do come in for treatment, the higher the chance of recovery. And so we need to maybe take away from our mindset the fact that, you know, when a person has an unusual behavior or an altered sort of, you know, psyche, that it doesn't matter whether they're male or female, they can seek treatment and get better.
But what is it that triggers violent behaviors? Because as you say, you can have aggressive thoughts and then never really behave in a violent way. Yeah. And does anger, in that sense, make you more likely to be violent?
Yeah, so we all have controls. And our controls are, you know, built from our, well, childhood, from, you know, the laws of the country, from our values that have been brought down. There are people who've been brought up perhaps with less exposure to the opportunity to have these values. There are some who may have inherited a certain type of personality. So people with antisocial personality have very little concern about the rights of other human beings. And they outnumber most of the other types of personality disorders in prisons. About 70 to 80% of all prisons have people with antisocial personality disorders. That's a disorder that's actually more common in men than in women. So again, leading to the reason why gender may play a big role in people being more aggressive and, you know, what do you call it? Violent as well. The other thing is when you're influenced by something like a serious mental illness, which makes you lose touch with reality, you don't have the boundaries anymore. You don't know what is right or wrong. When you use a substance and you're intoxicated, you again don't know what's right or wrong. And so then you start to act out and have no control over behaviors that you would normally have as well.
So if you know somebody who is at risk of violence, who seems to display aggressive traits, who seems to just be in that sort of state, what can you do? Is it like being, is that person a time bomb, or can it be neutralized, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, people who are close to them may be able to, you know, provide reassurance and comfort and help, because during that phase, very often they're under a lot of anxiety and stress, and they just need some, you know, well, some support during that phase. Of course, it's best done by people who are trained professionals rather than just lay people, because, you know, they may not know when enough is enough and to protect themselves. I think the important message is for people around them to actually tell them that this is unacceptable and that, you know, you're risking maybe going on to, you know, doing more problems and you need to seek help.
So when it comes to trained professionals, what do psychiatrists work on with their patients when you know that they do have violent behaviors?
Yeah, so essentially in our assessment, we would assess their potential. And so if they are highly aggressive or violent, then we would look at an environment that helps to control that. We would look at, you know, trained staff to help manage that as well. And we would also use medication to try and control the acute phase. We would then start to work to build a rapport and a relationship with the person and then get them to discuss what actually triggers off their anger and their violence and then look at ways of dealing with that that are more appropriate.
Unfortunately, not all of us are trained professionals, and you can encounter violence in your day-to-day life. You know, it doesn't even have to necessarily be somebody you know. How should you respond to someone who's being aggressive or violent? And are the strategies different when it's someone you know and love, someone who's close to you, and when it's, you know, just a stranger on the street who is behaving in an aggressive way?
Well, a stranger on the street who's behaving aggressively, I think you need to just not be there. Because you don't know their background, you don't know anything about them, you can't possibly think about approaching them and trying to, you know,
to help
calm
them
down. Yeah. But somebody you do know, you may be able to work on different areas. You may be able to explain to them that you're there to talk to them if they are willing to talk. But they have to do it in a controlled manner. And if they can't, then they may need to look at some other avenue of trying to control their anger and aggression. But you're not going to be the person who's going to be at the, you know, the what I call receiving end of the aggression. And so if things are getting out of hand, you either leave, come back later or, you know, another time, and then discuss what actually happened at that time and how that can be prevented in future as well.
Let's flip this around. What if I'm the person who's worried that I'm going to harm someone?
Yeah, so typically with violence and aggression, if it's in people who have no control, then they won't be, first of all, aware. Awareness comes with, the fact that they are still in touch with reality. They know what's right and wrong. And so then they're more amenable to try and work things out and change as well. And so when we do see people who are worried about being aggressive and violent, then we can help them through by assessing what is the underlying factor. And then management becomes easier as well.
We're talking today about the connection between violence and mental health. If you've got any questions about mental health, about your own or about someone in your life, give us a call. That number is 03-77109000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Mass murders are relatively rare, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But when you do look at specific events, how big a factor is mental illness?
Well, you know, the ones that we hear about in countries where gun laws are pretty lax. And so it doesn't happen, you know, throughout the world for people with mental illness and mass murders. But when guns are available and accessible, then they are able to harm and hurt more than just one person. And so then mass murders become a bit more on a higher rate. There are some reports that suggest that they may have increased over the years in the U.S. Specifically. And that's because the gun laws accessibility to guns have become even more, you know, wider than before. So I think it's about accessibility. I think it's about the environment. That plays a big role in, you know, how these sort of events get panned out in future.
The other step of that is heading into the courtroom. Has mental health as a defense been abused to escape punishment from the law?
Not in Malaysia. I'm pretty sure that doesn't happen in Malaysia. I'm not sure about other countries. I think it all depends on how good your lawyer is. And, of course, the forensic psychiatrist who's going to, you know, maybe do the assessment as well.
And here in Malaysia, is mental illness a strong defense? I mean, is it acknowledged in the court as something that really does factor in a very real way into somebody's behavior?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I had a patient who brandished a knife and went slashing people in a Pasar Malam one evening. And he was just an 18-year-old boy who had a lot of difficulties and was also hearing voices and was delusional. And he thought that everyone in the Pasar Malam were from hell and they were out to get him. And so, yeah, he was acting under the influence of a mental illness. He did not know what right and wrong were. And he did harm people when he was on treatment. He regretted his actions. In fact, he really, you know, felt sorry and wanted to apologize to everyone. Thank goodness nobody died, but he did cause quite a bit of harm. And the court did accept that he was, due to mental illness, that he, you know, he had committed this offense.
How would you tell the difference between somebody who is motivated to commit a violent action, not out of any sort of mental health deficit as such, but just, you know, other motivations, versus someone who needs mental health attention? So I suppose here the difference is between somebody who stole something because they wanted to and someone who stole something because they're perhaps a kleptomaniac.
Well, you see, there's two things. There's mental health and there's mental illness. And we go through good and bad mental health throughout our lives. I mean, every day can be, you know, a fluctuation of mental health where, you know, you start off the morning feeling positive and then later on you get some bad news and you feel down, and then later somebody says something, you feel angry, and, you know, so that's mental health issues. Mental illness is specific. You know, it has to have certain sort of criteria met for a certain period. It has to interfere with their day-to-day functioning. So if a person has schizophrenia, that's a mental illness. But people with mental health problems can commit crime because at that stage, you know, mentally they were a little disturbed but didn't have a mental illness. So I think everyone has got a mental health issue that provokes violence or provokes aggression. But what's behind that mental health issue is the important thing. You know, if you can't manage your stress and you don't have maybe a balanced lifestyle or, you know, friends that you can lean on, then, yeah, maybe perhaps your mental health problems become more. But people with mental illness can actually have a balanced lifestyle and learn how to deal with their stress and issues, you know, with interventions and treatment.
For the rest of us who aren't psychiatrists and who don't have that benefit of professional understanding, what are the best ways of figuring out whether someone in our lives is likely to become violent? And what can we do if we know someone who needs intervention? And I think this is especially important when it comes to things like relationships, intimate relationships, friendships even. Just anything, I suppose, where a person is very close to you and could do you harm if they became violent.
Yeah, well, often the telltale signs are always there. And sometimes when we are in a relationship or we know somebody and we know them well and we're friends, we tend to, you know, brush them off and believe that it's nothing great or big. But I think it's important for us to assess these things and see if they have a pattern. If it's happening frequently, then it may be something that the person is, you know, is unable to deal with themselves, and, you know, then it needs some assistance and support. I think the most important thing for a friend to do or somebody in a relationship to do is say you need to seek some assessment and get some, you know, support with dealing with this from a professional. You know, because again, as you said, we're not all mental health experts, but we can actually tell and we can judge, and sometimes we brush it down and pretend that it doesn't exist. But if we look deep enough, we can see a pattern.
What are the telltale signs and the patterns that we should look out for?
Yeah, so people who are becoming more sort of into themselves, reclused and aloof. I mean, some people perhaps have that sort of personality from young and they're comfortable with it. But people have suddenly changed in their personalities. If they're becoming, you know, more into themselves, if they're more critical about things and they're more sensitive about things, you know, little things like, oh, you were late and, you know, da-da-da becomes a big argument. And, you know, so things that stress them out are simple little things that you never experienced before. So these are warning telltale signs. Sometimes it's a temporary thing, you know, again, if it's a mental health issue, it's up and down and fluctuates. But if it's persistent, then it needs an assessment.
So when you said just now, if it's a mental health issue, I guess what you're saying if it's a mental health issue, just like all mental health, it could fluctuate. If it persists, then it's a disorder.
It may be
a disorder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And if that were the case, it's time to try to refer them onto a clinic or to a specialist.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just wondering, you know, how do you do that with somebody who is potentially violent?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's hard enough getting somebody who isn't violent, but maybe facing some issues to go seek a mental health professional out. But if somebody is prone to violence, I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, so the first thing is use the right language. And I think it would be not using the you word and accusing and criticizing, but more of the I word of, you know, I feel concerned, I feel worried. And looking at a medical model rather than the mental health model, especially in Malaysia, because a lot of people have different connotations when it comes to mental health. So looking at, you know, there are medical reasons why people lose control of their anger and temper and, you know, get more violent or frustrated easily. And so it'd be good to see perhaps a general practitioner or, you know, your family doctor to get an assessment. People with high thyroid levels can also have, you know, increased irritability, anger, and lack control over their aggression as well. So first medicalizing it, getting them to think about seeing someone, and then, of course, the general practitioners, some of them who are trained, would be able to assess for mental health problems as well.
And my final question to you, I think the answer you kind of told us right at the start, but yeah, I'll ask you again. So the bottom line is this. Is there a strong link between mental health and violence?
No. I mean, there is. It's just the same link as with normal general population. So there is no more violence among people with the mental illness. Saying that, mental health is, again, very different from mental illness. So people with mental illness can have poor mental health and then end up with, you know, increased aggression. People who don't have a mental illness can have poor mental health and also end up with aggression and violence as well. So mental illness per se is not going to cause more aggression or violence. That's the, I think, the overall message.
Thank you very much for coming in, Dr. Philip.
Thanks, Trilin.
I have been speaking with Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist, and we've been debunking the links between violence and mental health or mental disorders even. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.